Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Aha, feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. YouTube, hi. Thank you. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias! How about those dragons? It's time to hoop it up.
How about those dragons? No spoilers. We can't talk about the show. If you're not watching House of the Dragon, you should do so, though. Man. I am so... Steve, you know I am a big process person. I cannot express how frustrated I was with like 8 different people watching the second episode.
Could you believe the decision-making and the drama?
Okay, I'm not about to lean into this bit with you. But anyway, watch House of the Dragon if you haven't already. Happy to be with you. Recording on a Monday morning, so a little bit of a change of pace. But we do have some news for you, some transaction news going to jump off with. We're going to get to the rumor mill a little bit on the NBA side. Then we will flip to the WNBA side to have some news there. We've got a couple of previews for you. We're going to have some fun talking some hoop on this episode. We start on the NBA side. Big trade. Happening shortly after we recorded on Thursday. So I always love when that happens. But the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Chicago Bulls agreeing to a deal. Josh Giddey, you are a Chicago Bull. Alex Caruso, you are an Oklahoma City Thunder. Steve, your early thoughts on the move? How do you like the fit for both sides?
Well, I think with Oklahoma City, being able to add Alex Caruso to your team is obviously a big plus. He is the type of player that fits in to what Oklahoma City likes to do. The number one thing that jumps off the page to me is the defense. Being able to play defense with Lu Dort, that's a very tough duo to deal with. Caruso's ability to defend multiple positions. I don't know if OKC will lean in as far as Chicago did with, hey, are you a good player? Alex Caruso, guard them. But he's 6'9". Caruso. I don't know if they're going to go that far, but his switchability and dependability is big. I think especially coming off a series where they kind of got hurt perimeter defense-wise against Luka Kyrie, it makes sense. Making the trade that they did, I think overall, I was wrong about a lot of things with the Thunder, but in my mind, this felt like the year where they were saying, okay, how far can this group go? What are we going to need down the line? And I think when you look at Alex Caruso, his ability to space the floor, he's a veteran, he can defend, he fits what they're looking to do, and I think based on the Gordon Hayward move, you could tell they were trying to figure out, okay, what's the piece that we can get to during this time period to add to what we're doing? Caruso fits that bill. And then on the other end of the floor, this is someone who's a smart player, can drive closeouts, which is important in a drive and kick offense. Oklahoma City loves to go guard screens. Alex Caruso being able to be a screen and roll person, we've seen that work before. That should fit right in with OKC. So I think it's a really solid fit. So I would salute Thunder right there.
I got you. Like, I think with OKC, the first thing I tweeted out is like, hey, they better have Alex Caruso screening for Shea, and I am 100% here for it. But to your overall point, like, he just slots in relatively nicely into what OKC wants to do. I will screen. I will make the connecting plays inside the arc if necessary. If you get two on the ball against Jalen Williams, if you get two on the ball against Shea Gildas-Alexander, with the way that they like to set these early screens in transition or in early offense, like, he'll be able to flow on either side of that. And defensively, as you mentioned, he's one of the best defenders in the sport. He is one of the best screen navigators in the league. Strong post defender, strong isolation defender. The matchup versatility that he has pops. And being able to toss out Alex Caruso and Lu Dort, or on a night that Lu Dort doesn't have it, just Alex Caruso in place of Lu Dort, gives the Thunder a nice, just a level of versatility and optionality with their lineups. I think in terms of questions that I have, I do wonder where the three-point shooting lands with Caruso as he has gotten better as a shooter and, more importantly, got more willing as a shooter last year. Like 41% on threes last season, shot a shade under 40% on corner threes during his three-year stretch in Chicago, so can clearly knock the shots down. There were still pockets even last season to where he is open and he is driving out of open looks. And I think part of the issue for OKC in the Dallas series in particular, not just, hey, will the shots fall? There were a lot of instances of wide open shot. I don't know if I should take this one. So I do wonder, like, within a playoff setting, does Caruso not necessarily get over those demons because it isn't a fatal flaw of his, But like, how much does he aid OKC in solving that particular problem? Like, I think we both agree that he is a better shooter than Josh Giddey and will not be sacked off of as aggressively as Giddey was. But in terms of just the overall functionality, like, will Alex Caruso in a crucial playoff game be willing to take 5, 6, 7 threes if the situation calls for it? Like, that is just an early question that I have on that front. And as good as he is, like, if you feel like size is an issue for OKC, he doesn't help solve that portion of the program. So again, it's more so recognizing how good he is, but like, okay, how additive are those skills going to be in terms of solving some of the things that may have hindered OKC during this playoff run? So those are some of the early questions that I have, but an impactful player on both ends of the ball. Like, I just love the scheme fits both sides. It's kind of those margin things that I'm thinking about with Caruso as well.
Well, I know it's been a while, but he was willing to let it fly when he's with the Lakers. I mean, 3 attempts at 27% says there's a willingness here if I need to make a defense pay. I think the difference between Caruso and the other scenario is that he will have a stronger reputation and he may have to shoot his way into being the premier help point. But you can also move him around the floor a little bit more, and he's more of a willing playmaker in the sense of balancing, okay, I'm a ball mover. I can also make these shots. I can drive and finish. I can drive and attack. I think that just blends into what OKC does naturally. I think they can just kind of build off of it, and you can kind of tilt the floor in different ways using him as a screener if he's passing up shots or anything like that. There's not the same offensive expectation that there may have been with a Josh Giddey, with a Gordon Hayward, to where, hey, we expect you to do this. Well, no, Alex Caruso doesn't have to necessarily fill those gaps. He can make timely baskets and it can feel a bit different than, hey, why isn't Gordon Hayward shooting the ball? No disrespect to Gordon Hayward. So I do think that is a little bit of a difference there, just from a pure expectation wise. But you look at the style of play they have, he fits right in. If you remember back to two years ago, when Chicago was like, hey, we don't have Lonzo. It's going to be Alex Caruso and Patrick Beverley trying to move the ball, the rest of y'all figure it out. So, I mean, there's value to what Caruso brings offensively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that value's going to shine through. Again, if he does so consistently, like, this is a clear upgrade for OKC, even if we're just looking at, like, the playoff lens. What he brings defensively is just so much different than what a Josh Giddey provides or provided. And to your point about being a connective playmaker, like, he's not the passer that Giddey is, but in terms of quick decision-making, just puncturing gaps, a willingness to be used in a bunch of different ways, because we saw Giddey sprinkled in more as a screener last year, but it's just a different dynamic when it's Alex Caruso. One, just setting the screens because of how strong he is, how much he actually leans into and embraces contact. But on top of that, just being in that short roll situation, like, he is comfortable making those reads. And again, he has been a better shooter. So this is an upgrade for OKC. Don't want to get that confused. But again, just thinking playoff lens in terms of, like, overall the consistent shot willingness, I would say. Just going back to last year, or going back over the last 3 years in Chicago, 1.02 points per possession on any trip featuring a Caruso on-ball screen. Last year, that efficiency dipped, but in terms of screen contact rate was up there among guards and just with the league in general. So again, will fit in nicely into what OKC wants to do. On the other side.
It is a summertime edition of... Drumroll, please. Nekias Duncan yells at the Bulls.
So, I want to yell at the Bulls because I feel like Caruso was never going to finish his contract, much less career in Chicago, just based on where they were as team-wise. Nothing to say about how good Caruso is or how impactful he was, etc. This was a Bulls team that was in the middle. And so it just felt like at some point, because of where LaVine was health-wise and just because of, like, contract number slash play style with DeMar DeRozan, like, those are two players that are better than Alex Caruso. But in terms of trade value, they aren't, like, tiers above in what you may have been able to get at Caruso if you were to flip him at last deadline or the deadline before that. And so, like, if I have a complaint with Chicago, it's if you were going to wind up moving Caruso anyway, if you were going to find yourself going into, like, a soft, I can't even say that because I don't know if it's going to actually be a soft rebuild. I think it should be. And if you've been listening to this, if you've listened to this pod for a while, you know where I've landed on what the ceiling of this Chicago core is, especially since Lonzo went down, unfortunately. I've been of the mind, hey, I understand the vision. We got to see glimpses of it when Lonzo was healthy. when they were the one seed for 2.5-3 months. It's not going to be this, especially when you zoom out and look at what the rest of the East is. It may be time to pivot again. That's easier said than done. I'm just on a podcast mic, not making multi-million dollar decisions. But like I felt for a minute, they probably need to pivot. And so within that lens, it's unfortunate to see and read these reports of Chicago turning down, you know, multiple firsts at the deadline. And now your endpoint is Josh Giddey, who, you know, you kind of zoom out. Caruso and Giddey technically on the last year of their deals. Like you do just have the team control with Giddey being restricted. But that feels underwhelming within that context. So if there's any yelling for Chicago that I have there, it's probably just within that lens. Like you probably just could have gotten more for Caruso earlier if you were more realistic about where you are.
Are you ready for pushback? So this is the fun part about doing this pod. And this isn't necessarily my opinion, but let's have some discussion, eh? It's a different price, no? Different time of year? Why am I giving up a bunch of picks for Alex Caruso in the offseason and I got to pay him too? As opposed to, hey, we are looking to make a push. So that guy will help us. I will also pay him, but here's a pick. Please give him to me. Different sense of urgency, no?
Yeah. It is. But like that's where I think Chicago should have leaned into that urgency from other teams.
They was trying to do what they were trying to accomplish, the exact mission they accomplished. Did we compete?
Correct.
Yes. Did we get to the play-in? Yes.
You're 100% right. But like for me, my criticism has been, this is the ceiling. Like play-in, maybe get to six is kind of the ceiling with this group. I don't think that's worth pushing for. Like me, again, Bulls are very profitable, et cetera. So like they accomplished their goal, to your point. I just feel like that's too low of a goal for them to have. And so that's kind of where my inherent disagreement kind of comes in with Chicago as a concept.
Hey, you got to have hope and belief, man. Hey, it's our job. We put this together. We got to believe and hope it works. I would say this, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing about the picks, and this is just because I've heard a lot about how could you not get a bunch of picks? OKC has a bunch of picks. One, maybe they value the player they got more than a draft pick. Since they want to compete, mm-hmm. They're unsure about Lonzo Ball's return. Hopefully he's all right. They feel like they need a playmaker. Hey, instead of trying to draft one and find one, considering we're still trying to figure out what Dalen Terry is and what Ayo Dosunmu is, and we just got Kobe White, right? And what about Patrick Williams? That's what, their last four drafts? Maybe you avoid that. And let's go ahead and get Josh Giddey. And hey, if we got to pay him or Caruso, let's pay Giddey. We can always move him down the line. In 4 years, Caruso's going to be, what, 30 plus? Maybe that's the mindset there. Maybe that's the thinking process. And then secretly, if I'm OKC and we had some talks with this guard and he let us know the bench,
that's, the bench ain't for me.
That's not going to work for me, brother. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Well. Hey, Chicago, we got Josh Giddey available for you. There's not much of an incentive for OKC to attach a pick to that, considering they just started chopping him.
Yeah.
So just throw that out there, but continue.
No. That part's fair. And again, like I understand how they landed on this point, or landed to this point, rather. But beyond that portion of it, and I'd like tweeted out some very early thoughts after the trade. It's like, you know, like, I get why Chicago's making the swing with Giddey. Again, just from the pure asset/age thing. If both of these guys need new contracts either this summer or after next season, if we're committing to one and we've at least sensed a need to pivot to some degree, well, let's give the 22-year-old or 23-year-old the 4-year deal. Especially since considering what some of the limitations are right now with him as a scorer, it may end up being in the same range of Caruso anyway. I think the max extension that Caruso could get this offseason is, I think, what, 480? Somewhere in there? About 20 mil a year? And so if you feel like Caruso at max will command 480 and Giddey either this offseason or heading into next year, depending on what he does, if that's going to be 490, 4100, like that's a little bit higher, but cap is raising, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, cool. Let's take the commitment into the playmaker that is 7-8 years younger than the guy that we're trading. So, like, I don't think within that lens that's a bad bit of business. And then just with Giddey in particular, I think the flaws are obvious right now. He has become a more willing shooter. The shooting isn't there yet. Teams are willing to stash their bigs on him. If that isn't corrected in some degree, whether him becoming a snappier decision maker as like a handoff hub to kind of flow second side into things, or if the shooting just doesn't improve to a serious degree, there's a hard ceiling on what he can become as a player. That is inherent. That is fair to acknowledge, et cetera. I do think if you are now putting him in a situation to where, because you want the ball in his hands more, like you are limiting some of the off-ball, just some of the off-ball reps for him. If you can unlock more of the playmaking, like we did quietly see some scoring growth from him in terms of the process. We did see some of the footwork improve with some of the shots he was getting to inside the arc. I remember noting during some Thunder games we were doing watch parties, like, okay, well, he's comfortable taking this floater. He's getting to it a little bit quicker, a little bit more smoothly. The efficiency still has to improve. But you can at least see the shades of him getting better in that aspect. I don't think anyone has questions about what kind of passer he is. I'm not going to drop the the inbound nickname, et cetera. But we know what he can do in those situations. And in general, he sees the floor very well. And so for a Chicago team that, we'll say, isn't flush with great passers on the roster, like I think, especially with Lonzo being out, like it helps to add that piece. I do think, to your point about Coby White getting right and having the breakout year that he had and firmly putting himself in most improved conversations last year, like Coby can operate on and off the ball. I can see where Chicago is intrigued. And like, I personally want to see, okay, what exactly is this going to look like with him just getting the ball more? I don't think the context is perfect for him. I think OKC shoots / spaces the floor just differently than the Chicago group. We have an entire offseason to go. But in general, like, okay, let's see what some of these like footwork improvements and stuff means with him having more on-ball usage. Let's see what some of these lower angled pick and rolls look like if he's just getting to run more offense. Let's see what he looks like in a lower pressure situation, because OKC's signified by this move. We feel like we can win a title next year if we are reasonably healthy. And again, we have an entire offseason to go. With Chicago, to be kind, I do not think they will be competing for a championship next year. What does new environment / lesser expectation / ball in hand more look like? I'm not planting my flag on Giddy's going to be an all-star next year. That is, I'm not making that argument. But I am curious to see like what this situation is going to look like for him. You know what? I think that is a tremendous signal to pivot to other news on free agency. Anyway, the Sacramento Kings and Malik Monk expected to agree to a 4-year, $78 million deal, player option in the fourth year. Malik Monk last season averaged career highs in points at 15.4 and assists at 5.1. 53% on twos, 35% on threes, 83% from the line from Malik Monk. Very effective pick and roll creator. Was firmly in the sixth man of the year race last year. Just any general thoughts on Malik Monk returning to Sacramento? Because I thought he was going to be a very highly sought after free agent this year.
Well, the difference between sought after and in this era we're in, where if we can, we're keeping our talent. We may move on from it, but it's going to be via trade. And I think for Malik Monk to be able to get what he was looking for in the place where he is now popped, that's a plus win-win for everyone. Mm-hmm. And then for Sacramento, a little sigh of relief. Whatever moves we was looking to try and make, we know we have Malik Monk in tow. So now we can try and see what the next moves are going to be. And I think that's kind of the tricky part with some of these moves right now. Like with Chicago, it's like, what's the next move going to be? With Sacramento, what's the next move going to be? But you can breathe easy knowing you are going to have Malik Monk scoring back with you, and he's going to be locked in.
Mm-hmm. I got you. I think there was a report from, I want to say, Jake Fisher. Or no, it was Anthony Slater, as he was talking about some Warriors things. We'll get to that a little bit later in the program. But noted that the free agent market for some of these guards may not be as hot as expected, which played a role into Malik Monk deciding, hey, let me just take this 478 in Sacramento versus trying to push for 25 a year somewhere. Like Orlando was a popular name that was linked with Malik Monk heading into the offseason. And so if that's the case, it makes sense, as you said, like a spot that you have become the best version of yourself in. Like, we saw what the growth looked like the season before last. He got even better this year. We need to see what the chemistry is like with him and De'Aaron Fox on the floor together. If I can get well-paid, stay in a spot that I like, and continue to flourish in without having to worry about potentially getting squeezed in the free agent market, seems like a good bit of business for him. And for Sacramento, that's a big sigh of relief. And as you project forward, either, you know, the draft's on Wednesday, we don't know what kind of draft day or draft night trades may be made this week, et cetera. But, okay, cool. We know De'Aaron didn't go anywhere. We got Malik Monk. If we do actually want to pull the trigger on something concerning Kevin Huerter, we got Malik Monk. Whether we're getting another guard back and they start, or we're going to slide Malik Monk to the starting lineup if we want to, I'm glad we ain't got to worry about both of these guys potentially not being on the roster as we try to reconfigure some things around the course. So, seems like a good bit of business for both sides. As for some other NBA news / some rumors, we'll get into the rumor mill a little bit. On the actual news front, Drew Eubanks declining his player option per Adrian Wojnarowski. So he will be an unrestricted free agent this year. 5 points, 4 rebounds, a shade under a block in 15.6 minutes per game last season. O'Shea Brissett declining his player option, coming from the pal Keith Smith. 4 points, 3 boards, and 11 and a half minutes last year. We'll toss it to you. Do you have Eubanks or O'Shea Brissett thoughts?
Not particularly with the players. I think it's the concept is interesting as the balance between teams and players and trying to navigate the apron, the second apron, the new CBA, and what kind of deals can you get? Where can you get them from? Or could you technically get a raise by taking a new minimum? Are you trying to find the right spot where you can take that minimum, or maybe there's a little bit more money and now I can prove it and get some more money later? Like, there's layers and back and forth that are interesting that I think as we navigate through this offseason, we're going to figure out more the mindset of teams and players to try and find it. But I think what's really important is fit is so key these days, because the opportunity on some of these 1 year deals or 1+1 deals, if you don't cash in on it, now where do you go? What's the next step? Mm-hmm. Especially if you look into draft season, draft pick season, trade season, how do you keep yourself in that shuffle and how do you balance it from year to year? Because what you thought about Drew Eubanks 2 years ago, do you think the same this year? And now, do we need Drew Eubanks or are we about to draft someone who's Drew Eubanks? That's no disrespect to Drew Eubanks. That's just where my mind is like spinning to where
it makes sense.
I get what you're doing, but at the same time, you got to make sure you're A1, which I'm sure he is, but it's intriguing to watch some of the decisions.
Yeah, I got you. And I think with Phoenix, I think Damian Lee declined the player option. Eric Gordon may also decline his player option. So second apron is, I think Bobby Marks just dropped a piece earlier today, him and Tim Bontemps, about what the second apron can mean for these contenders heading into the offseason. Like, oh, this might be a little bit more complicated to navigate than even we thought when, you know, new CBA was agreed to and we knew what the second apron rules were going to be. So we may see just some interesting decisions in terms of who's being let go with like team options and contract guarantees and things like that. And again, kind of alluding to the Malik Monk thing, some of these guys you thought were just getting huge paydays may get squeezed a little bit as teams try to navigate, okay, what can we actually do this year and how does that affect what we may be looking to do in the next couple of years?
I will say real quick, Damian Lee accepted his. I will be back. Don't you worry. I see the opportunity here.
I'm good. Appreciate the correction, good sir. But got you on that front. I'll just say very quickly on Drew Eubanks, because you kind of alluded to, hey, it's your thought of him last couple of years or 2 years ago, same as what you think about him right now. I think it's fair to say it was very much an up and down season for him. Kind of landed on the underwhelming side for me. Like, I thought he was going to be a big boost for the depth for Phoenix. As someone that can screen and screen well, someone that can finish on the roll, has some, you know, some rudimentary passing chops on the short roll. If you get there and you got three guys that could draw two, and defensively, someone that could switch in a pinch while also maintaining a level of size. So I just thought, okay, he should be quality backup big man. And you saw that in flashes, but they were flashes, which is the issue. And I think as you just kind of saw what happened with Phoenix, the center room, Yusuf Nurkic played well, or if he wasn't available, or if he's had some of the dips, it's like, okay, well, now we're kind of pigeonholed into, we kind of have to play Drew, or let's see what Bobo plus KD looks like. And those minutes were generally productive, but this wasn't the year that I was expecting from Drew Eubanks. So I am curious to see, is this just a matter of down year for him, Or was there something physical to where, ooh, maybe he is now sliding from guaranteed vet minimum to Drew Eubanks is now in the camp where he gets back-to-back 10 days and then gets an end-of-season contract? Like, does he fall into that camp of, we know what you can do? Kind of, Bismack Biyombo, another example. No, he's a quality backup big man, but for most of the year until, like, the Memphis run and stuff like that. Okay, we know what you can do. Let's try some other stuff first. Oh, you're still on the market. Here's a 10-day, you did the thing that we know you can do. Here's a second 10-day, you did the thing we know you can do. Okay, just rot with us for the rest of the year. So I am curious to see if what happened in Phoenix with Drew Eubanks puts him in that camp, or if there's a team out there that needs to back up big. Like, okay, we just think that situation wasn't great for you. I think you can pop more a little bit. You can pop a little bit more here. So probably more Drew Eubanks content than people were expecting, but there you go.
Oh, well, since we're here, can I do breaking news specifically for Nekias?
Yes.
Per The Athletic, Shams says Nets forward Kata Bates-Diop has exercised his $2.65 million player option for the 2024-25 season.
Okay. Well, one, thank you, Steve. One's in the chat for Steve. Two, if I could take yet another opportunity to take an L on KBD, because buddy, was I super high on that signing for Phoenix heading into last season. I was doing like a big free agency grade thread on Twitter, and I was like, hey, if the shooting hits, this may just be the steal of the offseason. He was not the steal of the offseason. He did not complete his season with Phoenix. So we'll take the L on that front.
So it's TBD?
Congrats to him, goodness. You know what? Uh-huh. That's a good shot. That's, hey, well played. Well played. As far as other news, before we get into some of the rumor mill stuff and get your thoughts there, came pre-recording. The Cavs hiring Kenny Atkinson as their head coach. That one coming from Adrian Wojnarowski. And from the Athletic triumvirate of Shams Charania, Joe Vardon, and Jason Lloyd, they are confident that they can reach a contract extension with Donovan Mitchell. His max will be 4 years, $209 million. So we keep an eye on the Donovan Mitchell domino at this point. But Kenny Atkinson, head coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Steve, your early reaction.
Well, I mean, it kind of felt like a matter of time to when Kenny Atkinson would once again be a head coach. After the Brooklyn one, after what he did in Golden State. So it'll be interesting to see how he applies his offense to this specific team, because I think it's a good hand in glove fit where I can get some of this movement. I can get some of this buy-in. I can build on some of what we've done, but we also have some of the star talent. So we've seen him have success, obviously, with Jared Allen, but also it's not like Caris LeVert played bad. It's not like he hasn't gotten good things out of guard play. So there's a lot of pluses. So I'm intrigued to see what they do offensively. It's probably my number one thought.
Okay, I got you. Like, I like what you said there. Like, it does feel like a nice midpoint of we have young enough talent and versatile enough pieces to where I can implement some of the movement stuff that I want to do. It can kind of go the egalitarian route in pockets. But also, you know, with all due respect to, like, D'Angelo Russell in Brooklyn, like, I have Donovan Mitchell. That's just a different level of, if this movement stuff doesn't work, that guy can go get me a bucket. Or at the very least, get downhill, puncture your defense, draw an extra defender. Now we can just get into ball movement stuff. And so having that talent to accentuate some of the things that Kenny Atkinson already wants to do, that should be a nice fit. And as Atkinson's name has been kind of mentioned last couple of years with like some bigger profile jobs and ultimately didn't land there, there is expectation in Cleveland for sure. But it doesn't feel like it's the big, you know, major spotlight on Kenny Atkinson. So you still kind of have some of the, it's like smaller market feel, even though you have more talent there. So I think that also just kind of, it's a nice fit. It's something that I like. Oh, were you about to jump back in?
Well, I was going to say, there's also an element where, okay, because of the work Cleveland has done, and, you know, you don't want to discredit what J.B. Bickerstaff did as well, is this now, hey, we take that, we refine it, we add some more flow because the work will pay off. Is that hand in glove? Is that the kind of bit? We'll see.
Yeah.
Also, Detroit.
Yeah, I think James Borrego, who's also in the running, will become a more, you know, he's going to factor more into that coaching race, I would imagine.
Aha, speculation. So let's go.
Hashtag speculation. We will see what happens with Detroit. Now to the rumor mill as we've had some fun stuff. Mentioned Anthony Slater a little bit earlier from The Athletic. Just giving some Warriors nuggets. Also mentioned, again, the Malik Monk decision, how some of the free agent squeezing may factor into how he went back. There's reportedly no offer on the table for Klay Thompson as of now. Talks are essentially frozen between Klay and the Golden State Warriors. So talked a little bit last episode of just generally wondering, hey, how much of this is just leverage stuff versus Klay might actually be out of there? And seeing that report shortly after, it's like, oh, this actually might be Klay going somewhere else. This is weird, to say the least. So just continue to keep an eye on the Klay free agency. And ultimately, just what his salary number is going to end up being, whether he ends up returning to Golden State or if he does go elsewhere. Because I think it was, what, last year we got the report that Golden State offered $248 for Klay, and he was like, absolutely not. I'm curious to see, like, does he get $255 from someone on the market? That is interesting to me. Also on the Golden State side, they're looking to use Chris Paul's contract in a deal for an upgrade. Talks of moving his guarantee date, which is June 28th, into July as they try to search for a deal. Chris Paul, I think $30 million could be guaranteed. And so that would naturally help them bring in a bigger salary player. We've seen some rumblings over the weekend of the Warriors being in the ring of the Paul George sweepstakes if it goes that route, if it turns into an opt-in and trade situation with Paul George. Golden State, one of the teams at least interested in exploring that. So we'll keep an eye on that front. Golden State also expected to let Kevon Looney's contract become fully guaranteed. I think his guarantee date is today. Heading into today, $3 million of his $8 million contract was guaranteed. So nice to see Kevon. Kind of an up and down year for him as well, particularly health-wise, but he's been a mainstay of this Golden State run. Very important to what they've been able to do on both sides of the floor, particularly when he's been healthy. So nice to see him sticking around, at least for now. I guess first, any Warriors thoughts from you before I move to the next thing?
No.
All right, fair enough. From Yahoo's Jake Fisher, had a lot, period, in his most recent piece. But on the center market specifically, the Bucks gauging the trade value of Brooke Lopez. The Hawks continuing to shop Clint Capela around. He's on the last year of his deal, I think about $22 million. The Jazz are open to including Walker Kessler in the deal if it comes to it. And the Pistons evaluating the market of Isaiah Stewart. Any of those nuggets pop for you?
No.
Okay.
No, fair I enough. Mean, here's the, I mean, the, what? The teams are trying to figure out if they want this big. Teams trying to see if they want to move on from this big. What you want me to do with that?
You know what? Fair enough. I will say the Bucks are just interesting to me, period. Because they don't seem to have a ton of optionality with what the roster is right now and what just the asset bank looks like. And moving Brooke Lopez, again, no guarantee that he is traded. But just the concept of moving Brooke Lopez, I feel like is a tougher line to walk than people are giving credit for. Because he has just been the linchpin of their defense. Even if like Giannis has been better on the high end, just what Brooke's presence brings as a drop defender, as a communicator, and just what his screening and his spacing opens up on the other end of the floor. It's not easy to replicate half of that, much less all of that. And so if it does turn into Brook being moved because they're not moving Giannis, they're not moving Dame, and they either don't want to move Chris or won't be able to get anything or won't get an offer high enough to where they seriously consider it, I understand how Brook or, you know, by extension, Bobby Portis becomes next in line on that front. I just don't know what a Brook Lopez-less Bucks team looks like right now. Like, what do you get back for Brook Lopez to make that worth it?
It just looks like a team that doesn't rely on drop. I mean, here's the thing. Like, it feels like if the Bucks want to make an improvement, there's one of two people that they know they can trade. Brook or Bobby Portis. Mm-hmm. I think that's the bit there. We've seen Brook's name in rumors. We talk about shopping Clint Capela, the 1 year left. Y'all want him? He's available.
You need screens, you need rolls, you need blocks.
Do I think the Jazz would trade Walker Kessler? Yes. Do I think they want to? No. But hey, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. If you try and talk, it could happen. You know, and Detroit, hey, maybe we shouldn't play two bigs at the same time.
Huh.
There you go. Yeah, you got it out of me. Feel good about yourself?
All right. Well, the last thing, just the Wizards among teams to express trade interest in Mitchell Robinson. And Goga Batate being on the Knicks' radar if they decide to pivot on that front. The Knicks naturally want to retain Isaiah Hartenstein. They don't want to pay a whole bunch for the center room. So that coming from Ian Begley, that last part coming from me. But as far as the Mitchell Robinson portion and the Goga portion, that coming from Ian Begley. So That concludes the NBA rumor mill. We can now shift to the W side. On the news front, we got the first returns of WNBA All-Star voting. Asia Wilson and Caitlin Clark lead all vote getters. And as we are doing Team USA versus Team WNBA for this All-Star game, your top 10 in voting for Team WNBA: Caitlin Clark of the Indiana Fever, Aaliyah Boston of the Indiana Fever, Arike Ogunbowale of the Dallas Wings, Angel Reese of the Chicago Sky, De'Erica Hamby of the Los Angeles Sparks, Cam Brink also of the Los Angeles Sparks, naturally Cam Brink with the torn ACL, out for the season, Kate Martin of the Las Vegas Aces, Neko Ogumake of the Seattle Storm, Dawana Bonner of the Connecticut Sun, and Jonquel Jones of the New York Liberty. If we are removing Brink from the occasion, the next in line for Team WNBA in terms of just the player vote will be Camila Cardoso of the Chicago Sky. Steve, how did you feel about the opening results?
I felt fine. Like, I'm glad there's a balance between people voting for quote-unquote non-All-Stars and some of the players that will be featured on Team USA. It feels right that Asia Wilson's number one. It feels right that Stewie's number four. If there was no voting for overall All-Stars, we don't get Nafisa Collier at 9. And you got to remember, she was 15th in fan voting last year. So that's a cool thing for her to actually just get voted in, I think, to a degree. So I think there's some fun moments. Kelsey Plum gets elevated. Like, there's some neat things here. I'm a little confused with the uproar. When it comes to some of the fan voting, it is the fan voting. And you have to remember, it's only the people that get voted in that are automatically on Team WNBA. So if you're sitting here being like, why is Kate Martin getting votes? Because people like Kate Martin. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what to tell you. You also have to remember, there is a media vote and there is a player vote. And if you are unfamiliar with the player vote, do you remember the year that Sabrina Ionescu got a whole bunch of votes and the players were like, you're 19th in the W, bud?
Yeah, and that, boy, was that a lot of conversation surrounding that
one. So, what I would say is, everyone relax. I feel comfortable with saying I know some names will be in there. And plus, again, the pool list, the coaches are going to pick the rest anyway. So, things will balance out. I think Caitlin Clark will be an All-Star. I think Arike will be an All-Star. I think De'Erica, Aaliyah, and Angel Reese will all be All-Stars. Mm-hmm. Alongside NECA, Dawana, Jonquel. I feel pretty confident about that core, like, yeah. 8.
I think I'm right there with you in terms of, like, those 8 just being in. Like, as like Kate Martin may very well just end up being in the top 10 in the fan vote when this is done. I think fan voting ends on June 29th, so get your votes in. But once you factor in the players in the media, like, all due respect, like, I don't think Kate is going to end up getting in. I think if we are both agreeing to that core 8, like, after that, like, it's like Ezzy should just be in. The shooting has slid, but what she's been able to do defensively and just her overall versatility offensively, I think Ezzy's in. And then from there, like, unless I'm just forgetting a very obvious name there among the non-Team USA folks, I guess, would Skylar just be the other one? Would you just go with both the Storm guards? Would you go Kayla McBride?
I think Kayla and Brian being for me. I think Skylar's on that list, looking at my short list that I had made a couple weeks ago. Well, it gets interesting. If Ryan Howard's out and Benaja also hasn't played, does it just become Dejanay or Marina Mabry?
That does get interesting. In which case, DJ versus Marina, that does just get fun. Because, like, Marina's had a good year this year. As has DJ. I think she's going to be in the most improved talks again with what she's been able to do this year. I will say, like, the late free throws from Marina probably not leaving the best of taste in the mouth of voters. But does that part certainly gets interesting. So we'll keep an eye on what the fan results
going to be. Hey, like, you know what gets interesting? What's up? Stephanie Dolson and or Alana Smith push I'm about to make in 2 weeks.
Hey, Steve, who would you choose between Alana Smith and Stephanie Dolson this year?
Yes.
You know what?
Put them both on there. Now what you got, bud?
I see what's going on here. I see what's going on. Okay. That was that portion. And then just in terms of free agency news, The Sparks signing Queen Egbo to a hardship contract. Again, Cam Brink out for, expected to be out for the year with the torn ACL injury. So Queen Egbo, once again, changing jerseys this season, or this calendar year, rather. So we will see what Queen looks like with the Sparks. She has made her debut. I think she came in with a jersey that didn't have the name on it, which was, we got to get these produced a little bit quicker. I don't know how that works. I'm not actually, like, this is very much a joke comment for me. Like, I don't know what the logistics are of that, but, like, it was interesting to see jersey number, no last name on the back. But shout out to Queen. Hope she is able to make an impact. Steve, we had a fun Sunday slate, a congested Sunday slate. That's neither here nor there, but a fun Sunday slate nonetheless. But I think the game that a lot of people are talking about, very fun to finish, the Indiana Fever and the Chicago Sky facing off again, but an 88-87 victory by the Chicago Sky in this one over the Indiana Fever. We got late shock hijinks. We got a Caitlin Clark inbound. Elizabeth going for the lob, didn't get it to go. But Angel Reese with 25-16 in this game, her ninth straight double-double. Camilla Cardoso with 16-10, three assists and a steal. Kennedy Carter with 23 points and five assists. She has started the last three games. She is averaging 20 points per game during those starts, shooting 67% from the field. I think that's pretty good. Let's say her drives and her connection with both of those bigs have popped pretty much throughout the season. But as she's gotten to the starting lineup, obviously get more reps there. Caitlin Clark with 17 points, six rebounds, 13 assists, and four steals. She had 22 potential assists in this game, which was a season slash career high for her and the second highest total in a game this season per Second Spectrum. And, like, that's 22 potential assists that, like, that does not include, like, Kelsey Mitchell drops pass, so doesn't get to take shot. Not to single out Kelsey because other players bobble passes as well. But I'm just saying, like, off the top of my head, there were a couple where it's like, oh, that's an insane pass from Caitlin Clark that we're not even getting a shot attempt on. So, just one of the best passing displays I've seen in the game this year. Like, you have the raw numbers on it, but just the types of passes Caitlin was trying, and that was a lot of fun. Aaliyah Boston with 18-7-6, a steal and two blocks. Kelsey Mitchell with 24 points, a steal and a block in that one. Steve, what were some of your biggest takeaways from that game?
Biggest takeaways? I mean, it's just you saw the strength of both sides. You saw the growth of what the Indiana Fever have done. Which is, we have more balance, we have more teamwork, we have more ball movement, we have more flow. You know, I think a lot of times the conversation goes to, well, they stopped doing this, so now it's going through this person, and now it's going, it's balanced through everyone. That's the key for Indiana. Mm-hmm. It's figuring out how to paste all of this together to where, yes, Aaliyah Boston's playing a lot better. Yes, Aaliyah Boston's getting more touches in the post. Yes, Aaliyah Boston's getting more touches at the elbow. But that's positive. They just need to get her more touches. And so there's more decisiveness from Aaliyah Boston to where, hey, you know what? You're denied on this dribble handoff. Let me actually just drive. Or let me go to the other side and get another roll. Being able to get off-ball movement for not just Caitlin Clark, but Kelsey Mitchell. Run zipper. Actually, let me reject and bounce back to the side. You're getting some of the side-to-side action. Where there's one action with Caitlin Clark. Now go flows to the other side. Now it's Kelsey Mitchell. That's important. You're getting the pick-and-roll play where, hey, Aaliyah Boston screens for Caitlin Clark. You pre-rotate to that roll. We kick. You rotate to that. Extra pass. Three. More of those. I thought in that third quarter, you saw the payoff, not just for their overall balance as a team, but the work they've done in pick and roll, especially Caitlin Clark, just kind of see, okay, I'm going to get this pocket pass to Aaliyah Boston somehow. We're going to go ahead and make this happen. And then we're going to get two on the ball. Cool. Let me zip this to Kelsey Mitchell real quick. And then, hey, let me engage the big. Let me hit Aaliyah Boston rolling. That was really good. That extended that lead. But here's the thing about the Chicago Sky, right? You can say what you want about them. They compete. They're going to play hard. And especially on the nights where Kennedy Carter has that first step going and you can't defend it, when their defense is active and just sticks with it, when Angel Reese is playing at this high of a level where, you know, a lot of people looked at Angel Reese's stats and said, hey, it's this. Which, hey, I understand. But for me, it's a dangerous world when you only let the data confirm something for you. Let it shape an opinion, that's fine. But if you now put that person in only that zone, you're doing yourself and that player a disservice, because how are you going to track the progress? How are you going to know the difference? If you look at Angel Reese a few weeks ago, post up, trying to emphasize contact, trying to finish through contact, but you saw the effort, you saw the seals. Now we're seeing rim runs, seals, quick moves. one hit, I'm going. One hit, I'm spinning. Confidence in being able to finish through some of this contact now. That's plus. That's a buildup. You're seeing the interior passing between Camilla Cardoso and Angel Reese, where the spacing might not always be perfect, but hey, if I catch it and they help on me, I know you are somewhere in this vicinity, so I'm going to pass the ball to you. The buildup of the sky and being able to defend and kind of do some multiple coverage. I thought they had a really good stop in the fourth quarter to where Camilla was like, hey, I'm in this drop. Marina was like, hey, Aaliyah Boston's open. I'm gonna shoot and take that away. They figured to switch it. Angel Reese was able to show against Caitlin Clark, recover to Alyssa and defend one-on-one. But that's the make of that Sky team. Every night could be an adventure for them, but they're going to compete. So that's kind of what stood out to me. What about you?
Okay. I think for me, I like that you started with Indiana's offense, because the thing for me and what's been honestly just an interesting watch just with the Chicago team is how are they looking to generate offense? I think it is well established at this point. They don't have this expansive list of three-point shooters. They can't just go five out and get downhill and put defense in the bind, et cetera. They have to be a little bit more creative and a little bit more diligent about the looks that they're creating. And I think that plays a part into why you get Kennedy Carter in the starting lineup. Hey, we may not have ideal spacing. She can get downhill all the time. She's also a very good interior passer. So that can unlock at least some of the pick and roll attack for us. Or that can just unlock some dump offs. And with Camilla and Angel, in particular, something you've talked about with Angel specifically, as they've gotten better at establishing position down low, like you already alluded to the high-low pass between Angel and Camilla. Just seeing Camilla run down the middle of the floor, deep seal, Kennedy will hit Camilla. And if you send extra, help to Camilla post up or just a deep touch, she has the vision to hit Angel Reese on the other side, or she has the vision to hit Kennedy Carter on the cut if they want to go that route. And so like watching them figure things out inside the arc has been kind of fun. And you really saw that throughout that game. And with Angel Reese in particular, again, you've talked about her seals and her growth as a finisher throughout the year and have hit on it on the pod, on the timeline, in the watch parties. You deserve your credit for that. For like watching that play out in the game and, you know, more broadly and like less serious, like her versus Alyssa Smith was just fun to watch yesterday. Very clear, like they've played, you know, they played against each other before, years prior. Like it wasn't anything contentious, but Angel and Alyssa Smith were going back and forth all game long. Angel let Alyssa know early in the first quarter, I don't think you're going to have fun tonight. I'm going to be able to finish through you. I'm going to be able to hit you with a quick bump and then spin off. Or a quick turn into a finish. I can just kind of get to where I want to go against you. If there's a missed shot, I am outworking you for an offensive rebound. It feels weird to say Angel Reese only had three offensive rebounds, but she only had three offensive rebounds. But you can see how relentless she was on the glass, how relentless she was in attacking the basket. Again, the post seals were there. And beyond that, just her ability, I think I've made this comp before, like with her heading into the year. And it was more so through the lens of, does she have more ball handling / playmaking chops than people give credit for? Like this is something that I genuinely didn't know. And one of my things with Angel coming to the league is like, I know what kind of rebounder she is. Like I'm not a draft Nick, but know what kind of rebounder she is, et cetera. I had some questions about the offensive translation. And I said, like, I would shift that if there's like a BAM element of, you know, before LSU or Maryland or whatever, she was handling the ball. She could just unlock that portion of her game on the W side. Like that would maybe change how I feel about her ceiling. And like we've seen elements of her being used as a playmaker and being used as a hub, so like that stuff's there. But what also reminds me of Bam with her is she just gets to the free throw line so often. She is very good at seeking out contact. And like there were a couple plays early against Alyssa where she was like, what did I even do? But it's just like, no, you get the slowed down replay and it is catch, pivot. Your arms are up, but they're down. I can locate where your arms are and get a genuine shot attempt up and also get to the free throw line. She's such a smart foul drawer. I know everyone doesn't love all of the whistles that she get, like with just like anyone else. Like there are some calls you're like, hey, you probably could have let that one rock. But just in terms of her process, she's very good at getting to the line and seeking out contact. And I think as she continues to balance that portion of her game with finding different finishing angles and being able to expand on the touch that she has, she's going to be an electric scorer inside the arc. She's going to be a headache to deal with. You're already worried about the motor if there's a miss, she is just going to be in the hunt for it, whether she gets the rebound or taps it out or whatever. If she now can locate your body consistently and get to the free throw line, and or I can find these new pockets for shots and become better as a finisher, it's going to be incredibly tough to deal with. And I feel like you saw elements of all of those things in that game against the Fever. And so, like, that's probably the biggest thing with me with Chicago, just watching how they're interacting inside the arc with each other, particularly with that big three with Kennedy, Camilla, Angel. That was probably the bigger thing for me. And then naturally, again, like, just the cat and mouse on how are we defending this Caitlin action? What is this off-ball denial going to look like? Is this going to be a drop? Are we creeping up to the level and dropping? Is this just going to be a full-blown trap? Like, Chicago trying to mix in looks there based on the personnel that they had. Like, that was a cool just cat and mouse game within that. Those are probably the biggest things that stood out from that game.
So do you believe in the sky now?
Believe in the sky?
They good?
They certainly compete. Like, I do, like, the offense does, does still, it's hard to win when you just don't have three-point shooting outside of Marina, really. In terms of volume and efficiency, like that is just tough, especially when you come up against the upper echelon of the league. And, you know, sure enough, like, we got the Commissioner's Cup game, I guess today, by the time you hear this, it's on Tuesday. We have that. And then we get Ace of Sky on Thursday. If you want to talk about, you know, a styles make fights type game, the Las Vegas Aces go about offense a lot differently than the Chicago, you know, not different way than the Chicago Sky do. So, like, believe in the Sky to be, like, legitimately good, like, I don't think I can get there yet. I think there are just some hard limits on their personnel. But the defense is active. And again, like, they just maul you inside. Maul you complimentary, to be clear. Offensive rebounds, deep seal, general physicality. Like, you're just not going to have a good time dealing with the Chicago Sky. And so, like, you know, just the general skeleton, like, I can find enjoyment within the Sky. Believe in them to be, like, 6-seed potential upset pick. Like, I can't get there yet.
Are they good?
I don't think they are good, no.
All right. Someone clip that up, send it to Spoon. Angel Reese, shout out to Across the Timeline. Angel Reese, first WNBA player to log 165-plus rebounds, 30-plus assists, and 25-plus steals in their first 15 games. The fastest player to do that before was the great Yolanda Griffith. 17 games, 1999. So, doing elite things.
Impressive company. Yeah. Actually, on that front, we won't have to do like a full 20-minute segment, but who is your rookie of the year right now, heading into Commissioner Cup week?
Who's my rookie of the year right now?
Yeah. Like, obviously, a lot of season left. You know, ain't putting in the pen or anything like that, but just early thoughts.
Ooh, it's very hard. I know who my top two are. It's between Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, and I think it's probably going to go back and forth depending on the day. Yeah. I think Caitlin Clark's had a really good season. I think Angel Reese doing something we have not seen a rookie ever do before, so I'd probably give Angel Reese the nod right now, but it's neck and neck between those two. And then I'm between Aaliyah Edwards and Rekia Jackson for three, with Cam Brink being out, so there's my updated standings. Who's your rookie of the year?
I too have just kind of been going back and forth with this. Like, I've been trying to weigh, like, and to be clear, that more things go into this, but with those two, like, trying to weigh, okay, the Angel scoring efficiency is just well below league average. Like, she's getting better at it, but, like, where we are season wide, like, it's not great. And then on the other side, it's like the Fever as their, you know, recent surge over the last six games or so. But they are just flat out losing the Caitlin minutes, and like the on-off differential isn't that much different when she's on versus when she's off, like that kind of thing. Again, there are more that goes into like rookie of the year races and stats for me, but boiling it down to those two, like it's kind of difficult to weigh, okay, who am I dinging or how much am I dinging either of them for that? Because just looking at the numbers for both of them, just the regular numbers for both of them, just 16, 5, and 7 for Caitlin pretty much this year. Nearly 6 turnovers a game, a steal and a half, nearly a block. Above league average efficiency, Angel Reese is averaging a double-double. 13 points, 11 boards, 2 assists, nearly 2 steals. Like, I probably lean Caitlin right now just because of the on-ball responsibility that she has. and being able to take on that level of responsibility while still being above league average as a scorer, while also putting the passing display that she's put up so far this year. Like, I probably lean Caitlin right now, but like, it's very coin flippy for me right now, I guess is my overall point, because Angel has been very good. And as the scoring continues to get figured out, like, I think she's firmly been a positive defender all year long. And Caitlin has shown growth on that end as well. But I think it's fair to say Angel's just, she's a better defender than Caitlin right now. And like, the scheme versatility from Angel has popped in a way that I didn't expect it to so far this year. Don't have to spend too much time on the rebounding. She's leading the W in offensive rebounding right now. Yeah, like, all, I guess on-ball responsibility slash efficiency probably gives it to Caitlin for me right now, but that's, it's close. It is close. And then going 3 through 5, we're just getting the all-rookie team. Cam's just going to end up not playing enough games to factor in, which stinks. Like, I do think on a per-possession basis, like, she's been the third-best rookie this year. But removing her from the table, like, it's probably Aaliyah 3 for me. Probably Aaliyah 3, Rekia 4. And then from there, like, it, is it Julie 5?
You tell me.
Yeah, I'm just, like, it's just, like, it's a fun cast of, like, older rookie naturally, but, like, Julie's had a lot of fun in Washington this year. Like, I've enjoyed watching her and Aaliyah Edwards play off of each other. Like, it's probably Julie off the top of my head. Like, if you asked me this a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, it might just be Sevgi from Dallas. Kate Martin's certain. Well, we'll see what happens with Kate Martin's minutes, because as Chelsea Gray has come back, not the same role that we saw earlier in the year for Kate Martin. So, like, I don't know how strongly she would have factored in. Well, she wasn't going to factor into, like, the Rookie of the Year race. But as far as, like, getting spot 4 or spot 5, like, I think there was a fringe case for her. I think that gets tougher as the Aces get healthier. And now that we have this break for the Aces where they played over the weekend, but they don't play again until, again, Chicago on Thursday. Like, we may be close to Chelsea Gray starter at this point. And once we get that and Chelsea's at 28 or 30 minutes a game, like, Chelsea, Kelsey, Jackie, Asia, Kia, Alicia Clark, Tiffany Hayes, like, that's 7 right there. And if it's Meg Gustafson, that's 8. Like, I think it's just going to get tough for minutes with Kate, unless you're just doing maintenance stuff with Alicia Clark. So I don't know how much she's going to end up factoring in. But I do want to salute. Like, she's done a good job of filling gaps and has generally held her own defensively this year. So I don't want to completely discount what she's done. So I guess just for now, like, I'll go Julie Van Loo 5.
Okay. I respect it.
So we'll land there. And then we'll close things out as we have big game tomorrow on the W side, the Commissioner's Cup Championship. The Liberty looking to go back-to-back, taking on the Minnesota Lynx. Heading into the game, the Liberty, top team in the W right now, 15-3. First in offense, fourth in defense, second in net rating. The Minnesota Lynx, technically third in the league right now, 13-3. They are third in offense, first in defense now, after a not-so-fun weekend for the Connecticut Sun. They've now slid from first to second in defensive rating, a big drop there. But first in net rating for the Minnesota Lynx, in terms of the injury report, keeping an eye on Courtney Vandersloot and Benaiah Delaney Hamilton. Courtney Sloot has been out for personal reasons for the last few games, now has the return to play conditioning designation on the injury report. So she will return soon as she ramps back up. Not 100% sure if she's going to play on Tuesday night. Laney Hamilton's missed the last couple with a right knee injury. Her status currently unclear for that one. So there's that on the New York Liberty side. I guess I'll start broad with you, Steve. Like, I guess what types of things are you looking for in this matchup? This will be technically their second matchup of the year. They played early in May.
What types of things am I looking for? Basketball things. Types of things I'm looking for, Nikias. I think this will be a fun matchup. It'll be interesting to see them match up the second time around. Because they have similarities, they have differences, they have ways that they can both attack each other. And so when we're talking about both these teams, you're going to see spacing, you're going to see ball movement. It's going to be important to see which team can kind of get the other one in the mud to a degree. Quick question. Do you know what Sabrina Ionescu has been doing over the last 5 to 7 games?
Yes. Over Sabrina Ionescu's last 7 games, she is averaging 22.6 points while converting 52% of her twos, 42% of her threes on over 8 attempts, shooting 92% from the line. She's also averaging 8.9 assists and 1.3 steals over the last 7 games.
It's pretty good stuff. Now, can she achieve that against the Lynx? because there is a mindset with the Lynx where, hey, we have Nafisa Collier and we have Alana Smith and we feel like we can defend Jonquel and Stewie to a certain level, which is now going to put more pressure on the pick and roll. So you have to remember with the Lynx, there's an activity to their defense, both at the level and rotation wise. So can Liberty find the same kind of gaps consistently that they found over the course of the season? For the Lynx, it's been an important stretch for them to kind of find ways to win without consistently knocking down shots to the level they did early in the season. I think that's just a good journey for them. But I think this is one where they can use that versatility and the fact that they just have consistency throughout their lineups as far as being able to generate the same kind of shots, being able to space the floor the same type of way. And it's going to be on Liberty to choose what they want to do defensively. Is there going to be more switching? Can they get away with scram switching? Are they going to be active? That's where it gets interesting. But again, because of the size that the Liberty have had recently during this stretch, they've been able to tap different buttons defensively. So another fun moment where the Commissioner's Cup gives you two teams playing at a very high level and now facing off against each other. I mean, the Lynx won six in a row. Liberty had their win streak snap, but they both won 9 of their last 10 games. So it should be fun basketball.
Yeah. I think heading into this one, like my biggest question outside of like the health stuff, I don't know if Sloot plays, I don't know if Benaja plays. But outside of that, I kind of go to the Liberty's defense.
Shocker.
And like, do we just, gosh darn it. I can't win with this guy. No, I'm just kidding. But no, like I say that within the lens of the one regular season meeting that they had, where the Lynx go 14 of 28 from three, they went 6 of 11 from three in the first quarter. And those threes were early drag screen with an empty side. What are you going to do with Alana Smith? Oh, you're daring her to shoot. She knocks down shot. Hey, here's the pick and roll in the middle of the floor. Are y'all going to switch this or are we going the activity route? Oh, we have two on the ball. Here's a slip out. Here's a swing. Here's a wide open shot. Like it was, I think to this, like it was one of the worst defense performances that the Liberty had all year. I don't expect the Liberty to be that in this game. And since that game, they just have not been that. They have been an elite defensive squad. And to your point, because they've been able to lean into more size, when they have gone with switching, it's been cleaner. They've been able to switch more things because, oh, everyone's just big. Like, that's fine. To the scram switching, like, okay, cool. Sabrina's defending this drive. Oh, it looks like she may be beat. Hey, you go to the strong side corner. I got this, if you're Leo Feebish. And, like, them being able to just tap that button, which not dissimilar to what they did last year with some of the Sabrina drives defended, but being able to build on that with some of the reserves, with your Kennedy Burks, with your Leo Feebish. They just look, the one, they're bigger, but they also just look more connected on the end. So if they do decide to lean into more switching, I think they have the personnel to do so. They also are just humming right now on that end. So, like, I think they could do that more cleanly. And from there, you know, to bounce off what you said a little bit earlier about the Lynx finding ways to win without the shooting. Hey, if y'all don't have the same pockets against the drop, what are you creating? What is it going to look like? If you're going to the mismatch hunting bag, are you ready for 3-6-4 players to be trying to zone up on the back end or creep in for help? As the Lynx have been one of the best ball movement teams in the league, just in terms of their overall assist rate, they have just been the best team in the league. Hey, what does that look like against this Liberty group that may just switch everything? And now these passing windows that you've been able to abuse against other teams and even other good teams is not the same when Kayla Thornton is on the floor and Leo is on the floor and Stewie is on the floor and Jonquel's on the floor. What is that going to look like for the Lynx offense? And so for me, if the Liberty are cleaner defensively, the Lynx are comfortable in the mud. How comfortable are you in the mud? Can you generate the same types of looks? Because if you aren't able to do that and the Liberty are now able to get out in transition, we circle back to the top of the conversation. Sabrina Ionescu has been on an absolute heater. And quiet as kept, as Breonna Stewart has not shot well this season overall from deep, she's hit 50% of her threes over the last four games. And it's not like she's taking like two a game. So like, if the Stewie jumper is coming back, if Sabrina's on the heater, Jonquel's been shooting well all year long. We know Leo can knock down shots. We know Ivana Dorkic, when she's out there, she's very willing to take shots, but like overall, she can knock down shots. Like this could be like just a, you know, just could be a bit of a reversal here. Like we may just see like the Liberty just bomb away against the Lynx in this one. Like it's kind of similar to my thought heading into the Suns-Wolves series where I was like, you know what? I kind of feel confident about Minnesota. Because, like, I don't think Anthony Edwards is going to be as bad in this series as he was during the regular season series. like, just circling back to that regular season matchup, I don't think New York's defense is going to be what it was in that first half. And if the defense is better, like, I do just trust their talent a little bit more than Minnesota's right now, as they haven't shot well as of late.
All right, long-term dunkers, I need y'all to clip that segment for me, and we'll revisit it on Wednesday. I think the one thing about that early season Lynx-Liberty game is it told the story for both teams, where the Lynx did come out to a huge advantage. The Liberty were able to come back, but then the Lynx jumped back on them again to say, hey, we're here. Liberty knew what they had to work on, so that's where I want to see what it looks like. I think the one thing with the Lynx is they are going to make New York sustain their defense. So even if you're able to mix in more switching because you have more size, they're going to make you keep guarding and keep making decisions. And so that's going to be interesting to see how the Liberty handle being tested that way, because even during this win streak, there have been pockets where the Liberty offense has kind of gone to the left and teams have been able to hang around, stick around and make those plays. And with Minnesota in particular, that's a dangerous deal. When you have someone like Courtney Williams, who tends to like to shoot pull-ups against the Liberty, Kayla McBride's movement, Nafisa Collier in general, it can get kind of tricky. And then as they sub, you got Dorca, who feels that she could defend anyone to make threes. That's the fun of this matchup. So I want to see how both these teams respond to this environment, but I can't think of a better matchup. That's no disrespect to the Aces of the Sun. It's like, if you want to see, this should be a really fun, high tempo type beat, which is very funny considering they both hold their teams under 80 points a game.
Yeah, like, again, these are a pair of elite defenses. And elite offense, they're number one and number two in net rating this year. Like, these have been, by that metric at least, they have been the best two teams in the league this year. And so this should indeed be a fun stylistic clash. It should just be fun, period. A lot of star talent in this one. We talked about Sabrina. We talked about Jonquil. We talked about Fee. We talked about Stewie. Like, we're going to see Stewie and Fee just defending each other. So, like, I'm amped for this one. I will say quickly, this feels like if I'm trying to pick out an X factor for this one, like, this feels like a big Atlanta Smith game, or it's going to have to be for the Lynx to be able to pull this off. Because as well as she's played, and I think, like, she's firmly in all-star consideration, especially if you're just looking at just the team WNBA side. With her, like, teams still haven't fully pressed the "we have to defend her all the time" button when she's on the perimeter. It's what's up?
How many threes she got to make before? I just want to know between you and me, because we watched the Mercury not guard her in the first half, and she bopped all of those. So how many threes is she gonna have to make for you?
For me, it's more about how many threes she's gonna make for defenses to shift. Because again, I go back to last season where she got off to the super hot start from three in Chicago. First 10 games, she shot 41% on, I think, 3.4 attempts in her first 10. And then over the next 30, it was like 23.5%. And it was like, well, that's unfortunate. She has once again gotten off to a hot start from three, and the volume isn't super different from what it was last year. For me, as someone that enjoys watching her play, and I think you were first to the Atlanta Smith bandwagon last year, but like, as someone that enjoys watching her play because of the screening, because of the passing, because of the shot blocking, because of the activity when defending pick and rolls, being able to add in that shooter element just takes her to a whole different tier of player. She is shooting well now. If she sustains that, she's just firmly an all-star talent. I just worry, like, long-term is just like, hey, will this tail off? And if so, what does that mean? Because again, to your point, in that Phoenix game, they left her open. She made them pay, but the general point is they did leave her open. There does have to reach a point where she hits, like, the volume/efficiency threshold to where teams are like, okay, we can't even do that against her. Or at the very least, we're containing the drive. We're pre-rotating someone to her immediately to make sure that she can't get off. So I'm just kind of waiting on defenses as a whole to kind of get to that point. And within a single game sample, okay, you're probably going to be left open on some of these pops. You have to make them for the Lynx to be able to win this game. That's kind of the quick point I wanted to make.
But how much of that is just her being defended by bigs?
That factors in, for sure.
No, I only say, like, how is it really going to shift if that's just kind of who's defending her? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to that point, like, I think that would probably factor into, like, the pre-rotation point more than, okay, we're just switching everything involving her.
Okay.
All right, fair enough. Any closing thoughts or questions on Link's Liberty?
No.
Okay, fair enough. Beyond that, any teams or players you want to shout out or any W thoughts before we head out of here?
Are you ready for Seattle Storm 2 seed? The homestand has begun. I'm just saying.
Yeah, they're just not going on the road for like a month.
Just saying. There's a lot of home games for the Storm, so watch out for them. Are we worried about the Connecticut Sun? And I mean that as a rhetorical question, because they had lost two games in a row, lost to the Aces, lost to the Storm on the road. The offense went to the left. And I don't think it's concern. Like, I'm not going to do the thing where now people call Connecticut a fraud and then they come back with the disrespect and now they go on another run. Like, they're a very good team. But I think it's matchup based for Connecticut, to where you play the Aces and they can slide in with unders and Asia can score on the other end and we can help off Bree Jones. We have size and we make it tough on you. And the Storm, where it's like, actually, you know, we can just switch a whole lot of this and we also have size and we can help and we can mix into unders. So now it becomes, for me, they have a comfort in the mud, but what kind of shots can you generate against some of these top teams? Can you force rotation? Can you get downhill? Or are you going to be constantly fighting an uphill battle and have it to defend? So that's one thing I'd say about the Sun. I'm just going to go rapid fire real quick. Okay. So the Atlanta Dream. That's it. That's the tweet.
That's just...
The Las Vegas Aces with Chelsea Gray, once again, look to be the Las Vegas Aces. So salute to them. I'm very intrigued by this. I don't know what to do with the Fever Sky Sparks Mystics Wings combo. Those are my main musings. I'll let you go off that.
Okay. Well, I would just say very quickly on the Wings front, like, I guess I'm just keeping an eye on Enrique, because again, anytime Achilles soreness enters the injury report, I'm just like, hey, are you actually good? And as someone that can generate shots whenever they want to, but like relies on the quickness to be able to do so, the quickness in finding shot pockets, the drives, the quick side to side movements to get into step back, stuff like that. I just generally worry about Enrique. I just hope that if she's playing at 85% capacity, I probably look at the record and say, you know what? Let's make sure she's good. That kind of thing. But Enrique is playing. Natasha Howard just back and starting again. So nice to see her back on the floor. But I just kind of roll over my I feel bad for Dallas a note, just because of all the injuries they've had to deal with and all of the just a whole lot of hardship signs they have to sort through, et cetera. On the Atlanta front, goodness gracious, the offense is just rough, like in terms of advantage creation. And like a lot of that is just Ryan Howard just isn't there as she's dealing with the ankle/leg injury, as we just get more and more vague with injury reports these days. Well, that's another podcast. But with no Ryan, like it just gets tougher for them to generate offense. It's a lot of reliance on Alicia Gray and a lot of reliance on Tina Charles, who has played well this year. But like, it just doesn't feel like they bend things enough. And there are so many side-to-side possessions derogatory for them, where it's like, oh, y'all really don't have the jump start yet. And that's where I hope, like, Jordan Canada made her season debut on Sunday. Foul trouble game, didn't play much. But that's where I hope, like, Jordan, her drives being important can help open some stuff up for the Dream. And we see the offense perk up at least a little bit. But it is looking kind of rough for Atlanta. And then watching the game yesterday and finding out that the Mystics just have the Dream's first round pick this year, I was not ready for that revelation at all. That's one of those, like, we probably talked about that trade when it happened and different swaps and stuff like that. And now we just circle back a year and a half later. It's like, oh, snap, they have that pick now. So, like, even if you want to press the, hey, Ryan ain't right, let's just hold her out, let's just tank, reset, et cetera. Like, they can't do that. You'll be looking for, like, pick 13 in the second round, or the first pick of the second round. Like, you don't even get the immediate benefit there. So, like, that's just an unfortunate situation in Atlanta. I hope they're able to turn it around, if for no other reason, just for Tanisha Wright's sake, as it feels like she's getting progressively more fed up with both the team performance and the questions about team performance afterwards. So I just hope there's just a give the Dream a 3-game winning streak soon. Like let's get some positive vibes in Atlanta.
Hey, I didn't mean to cut you off real quick. Do you have another musing?
I was just gonna bounce off the sun thing, but that can wait.
Oh, I was just gonna say real quick. At any point in time, if I start to speak, can you look up the 3-point shooting from the Phoenix Mercury on the road?
Sure can.
Okay, but bounce up. I guess I'll add real quick before you get to the sun point. Mm-hmm. Boy, this top 4-5, it is up and down. Like any of these teams, I feel like with the matchups, it could be really tough. I think Atlanta, they just got to, hopefully they can get healthy. I think either the defense needs to pick up or the offense needs to pick up. If they can get one of those sides right, they can probably survive some of these in a different way than they have right now.
I got you. Just quickly, the Phoenix Mercury, 29.1% from three on the road. That is 10th in the W. But when the Phoenix Mercury are at home, however, shoot a sterling 38.1% from three, which is second in the W to the Minnesota Lynx.
Okay, so styles make fights, eh?
Yeah, the offense traveling, etc. To the Connecticut Sun point, to answer, it was a rhetorical question, but to answer your rhetorical question, since that's totally how that works, not concerned about the Sun within the lens of this isn't anything new. Like, this was a question I feel like we both kind of touched on heading into the year. Will they be able to get enough offensively? And more specifically, hey, what are the guards going to do? Because they have to be able to complement what Alyssa Thomas does, what DeJuana Bonner does. If we're still waiting on like the super consistent run of 3-point shooting for DeJuana Bonner, I'm confident that will come. But you need consistently aggressive / productive Ty Harris. You need consistently productive and efficient Tiffany Mitchell, as it's been a very up and down season for her. You need the 3-point shooting to be consistent for Rachel Bannum. You need the drives and the shot to fall for Dejanay Carrington. If we're going more guard / wing room in that case. And like when it isn't there, to your earlier point, yeah, it is kind of easy to just mix in, you know, the switches and the unders. If we go under, we're not confident that you're just going to immediately pull from deep. It's going to be the automatic rescreen. Y'all get downhill. We see what happens there, but we have help points. We kind of funnel shots. Okay, if this is going to be a pull-up too, I think we're okay with this. And so, like, there does have to be a consistent willingness to, if we're going under or if it's a switch, okay, Ty Harris, this is a gap. You just kind of have to take this pull-up three. And we've seen that in spots throughout the season. So it's not a matter of can they do it. It's more can you do it consistently. And I think when you face a team like the Aces, when you face the Seattle Storm, when you face the Liberty, like, you're going to have to, there aren't going to be many pockets to attack. And so the ones that are given to you or that you are able to create, you just have to puncture those when you have them. Because if you don't, to your point, they're comfortable being in the mud, but that generally isn't going to be a consistently positive formula for you against the upper echelon. So like, not concerned, because these are questions I already had, but this is something that Connecticut is going to have to solve. And then as far as shout outs, wish I could have got to it on Thursday, honestly. Because now we're just fresh off of the second Liberty matchup where she had 2 points. But before that, 6 straight games of double digits for Aerie McDonald. It was cool to see shots falling for her. In addition to just what she brings defensively, during that 6-game stretch, 14.7 points, 4.5 assists, 1.2 steals, shade under 44% from three, 54% from the field overall. She has a very cool floater. And so just watching her just blow past folks and just stop on a dime and get to that floater, or hey, we're going under Aerie McDonald. Oh, that's fine. I'm going to stand right here and take this 3-pointer, and we're going to knock this down. And then again, just jersey-to-jersey defense for her. Like, watching her off ball. Like, I think she was, yeah, it was Aerie earlier against the Fever. They had the clip kind of going viral. She took the first free throw and then immediately went to the face guard against Caitlin Clark. But it's just like, no, she is generally just that kind of relentless defender. Like, that clip itself was funny. But, like, she gets after it on the defensive end. And so it's been cool to watch her as, you know, I had questions about the Sparks guard room heading into the year. It's been nice to see her have this run of, I will make the basic reads as a playmaker, but also here's some complimentary scoring to help keep things going. Here's some hard-nosed defense to help set the tone. So I just wanted to shout out Aerie McDonald and the play that she's been able to put on the floor over the last couple of weeks. So I think that'll do it for me. Again, keep an eye on the Aces, their starting lineup. It was Alicia Clark, then it was Tiffany Hayes. Again, big break, so we'll see when Chelsea Gray enters the starting lineup. Hopefully get some answers throughout some of these practice availabilities, et cetera. We'll see. But I think that does it for me.
Go ahead and rub those horns.
All righty then. Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. We are on JJ Reddy's YouTube channel. So check that out. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you haven't already. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. If you haven't been, the NBA season is over with, but basketball season is not. So if you want a cool second screen experience, watch some W games, have some fun, talk to some cool people, you can rock with us. The link is in the podcast description. So click on that. It's free to create your profile, no shenanigans. Come rock with us. Come have some fun with us. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.